This is NDPR's Jazz Beat. I'm Tom Reaney with a podcast edition of my jazz blog, which you can find at nepr.net. Today's Jazz Beat podcast focuses on Bill Mays, the piano great who has just published a book. It's called Stories of the Road, the Studios, Sidemen, and Singers, 55 Years in the Music Biz. Bill Mays' recordings are often featured in Jazz on the Mode. Our conversation took place on Wednesday, June 15th, 2016. My guest today is Bill Mays, the veteran pianist who has recently published a book called Stories of the Road, the Studios, Sidemen, and Singers, 55 Years in the Music Biz. I guess that would qualify you as a veteran, Bill.
And it's nice
to be with you today. You know, Bill, before we get into the book, I just wanted to bring us up to date. We're here in Springfield, Massachusetts, and we lost one of our great Springfield natives last year with the death of the saxophonist Phil Woods. I know you played with Phil, and you played recently out in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, a memorial concert for Phil. How about a few reflective thoughts on Phil Woods?
Oh, man, I loved Phil greatly and played in his band the last 8 years of his life. I worked with him starting in the late 90s, but actually became a member of the band about 2008, something like that. Anyway, Phil was, not just one of the greatest ever, but was a real inspiration as a band leader and a composer to me. I learned a lot playing in his band, and the guy had one of the best senses of humor of anybody in the music business, and that was a joy as well. He's from Springfield, of course, and Grace Kelly played the alto book when we did the tribute concert to Phil in Pittsfield a few weeks ago, and a couple nights in New York and out in Pennsylvania. And she did a beautiful job. It was like being on a bandstand with the quintet. You know, we just played tunes from Phil's book. So that was a joy.
Oh, that's nice to hear. I was at the concert in Pittsfield about a decade ago when Grace sat in with Phil, and that began their relationship. And that was a surprise to everyone. Grace showed up with her father that day and made her presence known, and Phil invited her up. They played I'll Remember April. He gave her his leather cap that day, and that's become kind of a talisman of hers ever since. But
in fact, she wrote a tune called The Man in the Hat, and nice bebop tune we played it the other night.
Oh, yeah, nice. And you mentioned Phil's sense of humor. I think of that as a real survivor's sense of humor.
You know, you have to have a great sense of humor to stay alive in the music business. There's so much weird stuff that happens. You got to, you know, laugh at it and roll with the punches, and Phil sure had that.
You know, speaking of a sense of humor, there was so much of that that comes through in Stories of the Road, and you know, most of us have a certain kind of like narrative kind of lineage in our lives that just, you know, connects dot A to dot B to dot C. But Bill, I have to say, the range of musical settings that you've worked in, the number of musicians is just dazzling, and it kind of upsets the standard narrative of even a musician's life. And I wonder if you agree with that thought, and what you could say about just the amazing range of people. How is it? What do you think about yourself, your gifts as a pianist, and as a musician that you've been able to work with so many different artists?
Well, my career has really been kind of divided into three segments. I started out in San Diego when I was fresh out of the Navy. I was incidentally a musician in a Navy band for 4 years. And when I got out, I joined the Musicians Union in San Diego and started working there, and just did like many musicians back in that era where we had the opportunity to do it. I took every kind of gig imaginable, from playing nightclub gigs to working in the studios in San Diego doing some jingle work, and was lucky enough at the tender age of 21 to get a gig, a daily TV show 5 days a week in San Diego, and that helped prepare me for my move to Los Angeles, where I worked as a studio musician for 15 years from 69 to 84, and that was really a golden age. There was a lot of work in Hollywood. Probably 600 or so musicians did all the studio work that there was to do. And as a pianist, I was also a multi-keyboardist. I was called upon to play harpsichord and Fender Rhodes and organs. And this is before synthesizers even started. And so while I was doing studio work, I was also playing jazz on a limited basis in Los Angeles. And in fact, that's at the start of that period, I got the gig with Sarah Vaughan and worked with her for a year and a half as her music director and pianist. So that was one period, and then I moved to New York in 84 and started working with Jerry Mulligan. The moment I got to town, I got the gig and stayed with Jerry for a few years. And at the same time, was doing a lot of sideman work from, you know, subbing on the Village Vanguard band. Mel Lewis was still alive and leading the band, to working with Bob Mincer, Al Cohn, a host of others, and eventually started making my own albums for labels like Concord and DMP and Steeplechase and who have you. And so as I say, my career has been kind of in three segments, as a sideman and now leader, and also as a composer and an arranger. And I had a lot of time in working with singers, as as you can see in my book. There's a whole chapter devoted to singers and a lot of funny stories there.
Right. And the last page of the book is a list of the singers you've worked with. It must be close to 200 in number here. Well, and I wonder if many of these were just sort of one-off situations.
I had nothing to do one day, and I sat down and said, how many singers have I actually accompanied? And I made a list. I started looking at my record collection and the notes that I'd taken down through the years. So I included everybody in there, whether it be an instrumentalist that sang, like Red Mitchell, like Jerry Mulligan, I included people like that. And also people with whom I had a long association, like Mark Murphy and Sarah Vaughan. And I included people in there that I even worked with. I think the shortest gig was 5 minutes, where I subbed for Mike Renzi with the singer Placido Domingo, the opera singer.
Oh, yeah.
So I included him because I did work with him, though it was short-lived. So that was just kind of a lark to make a list of all the singers. I think I included my mother in that list, too. That wasn't a professional gig. It was just accompanying mom in church.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of an interesting and certainly an eclectic list. Mm-hmm. Everybody from Leonard Cohen to Al Jarreau to the Jackson Brothers and Shirley Horn and, you know, range.
Let me ask you about a couple of those singers you worked with. Frank Sinatra. Tell us a little bit about your gig with Sinatra.
Yeah, this was maybe 5 years, 4 or 5 years before Frank passed away. Of course, his longtime accompanist was Bill Miller, who was with Frank for maybe 50 years or more. And the boss and the company wanted to try Bill Miller conducting instead of playing piano. So that's how I got the call, and I worked with Frank for maybe a couple dozen concerts over a few-week period. Bill Miller didn't work out or changed his mind, whatever, and went back to being the pianist and not the conductor. So that's how that gig came about. At that time, Frank was using the full orchestra, so we would play these huge arenas and huge halls, and he'd come in with his bodyguards and all these screaming women. It was the closest gig to working with a rock and roll star, I guess, as I'd ever gotten. He was, all those women who had loved him as Bobby Soxers, and then their daughters and granddaughters. Mm-hmm. He was still hugely popular at that time. And I think that one of the most thrilling things about that gig, as short-lived as it was being in the middle of the orchestra and hearing all those wonderful charts mm-hmm. by Nelson Riddle and Gordon Jenkins and Billy May, mm-hmm. sitting there and hearing it like I'd never heard it before because I was right in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. It's a great experience.
Right. Did Sinatra give you any indication of his approval or appreciation for your playing with him?
Good question. Yeah. His words to me when I came to the first and only rehearsal with the orchestra, he said, "Welcome aboard, kid." I was in my 40s or even maybe my early 50s. Right. And I said, "Thank you." And then the next interchange that we had, I was walking past his dressing room one night before he went on, and he said, again, "Kid, hey, kid, you like Rachmaninoff?" I said, "Sure, I love Rachmaninoff. Why do you ask?" He said, "I'm listening to one of the concertos." So that was my experience with Frank Sinatra.
Right. You had a lengthier experience with Sarah Vaughan, and one of the vignettes in your book mentioned working with Sarah and Duke Ellington. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was with Sarah in 72 and part of 73. Most of the gigs were trio. And it was Bob Magnuson was the bassist, and the legendary Jimmy Cobb was mm-hmm. her drummer. And she usually did, as I said, trio gigs, but a few things were big band. And this one booking was with Ellington's band. We did, I think, a week at the Coconut Grove and a few gigs in Canada. And it was notable. A lot of the guys in Ellington's band at that time were not great readers. They knew the music inside out. Many of them played the whole book without looking at the music. It was memorized at that point. But we had a shaky rehearsal, and Mercer Ellington was on the band at that time and helping manage the band, and he split everybody up into sections, brass in that room and saxophones in that room, and rehearsed. And we got had a good opening after a shaky start, and the band sounded great. I think probably the most fun I've ever had with a singer might have been with Sarah, because she was like family. We would hang out a lot after the gigs and play word games and eat and drink together. It was a very fun experience.
Mm-hmm. You've worked with so many artists, I can't, sort of underscore that enough, but another one that that really surprised me was your encounter with Phil Spector, including Phil brandishing a gun. Did you feel threatened by him?
Well, not really, though in retrospect, it could have been disastrous given the turn that his life took, the murder charge, and
right.
subsequently spending time in jail. The gig was a record with Leonard Cohen. He was the artist. And Phil had this musical vision that he called a wall of sound, and what it was, he would use two or sometimes three of each instrument. So there were probably three keyboard players on the record, and there were two or three guitarists, and he marched us all around the studio before we started to record and led the band. He was dressed kind of like a drum majorette in white boots, and with it was bizarre. And so Bobby Bruce was the fiddle player on the date. And I remember that Bobby and the rhythm section, some of us were in the booth listening to a playback, and Spector pulled out a gun. He said, "That was a great take, everybody." And he pointed the gun around the room. He said, "But I think we can do a better one, right?" And he laughed diabolically.
Oh, right.
And so that was just a few weeks before he actually made the news by shooting a few holes in the ceiling of A&M studios.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
bizarre.
Yeah, right. Aretha Franklin. You work with Aretha and helping her prepare to sing for the Queen of England, Elizabeth II.
Yeah, it was Aretha. I learned did not like to take planes, didn't like to fly, and so instead of going to the, I think it was called the Silver Jubilee in London, she did a performance that I played. It was just the two of us. She sang an aria from a Handel opera called Xerxes, and she, Phil Ramone was the producer, and we did it in a TV studio in New York, and they digitally cut it in to the performance so that it was part of the, she was not live, but it was part of the live performance in England. Mm-hmm. And that story is too long to relate. So I would encourage people who, let's get a plug in here for my book.
Sure, go to it.
It's in the book.
Go to it, man.
Yeah. It's a hell of a story. This book, I'd like to say, incidentally, I made a decision when it came out 2 years ago to donate all the proceeds to the Musicians Assistance mm-hmm. Program. Mm-hmm. So it's the best $20 anybody could spend. It goes to a very good cause, and I think readers are highly entertained with all the stories. As you said, it's not a biography. It's really a collection of humorous and thought-provoking anecdotes from my long and varied career.
It made me wonder right away, Bill, do you keep a diary, a journal of...
I do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I write down all kinds of things and had for decades, and that was part of what spurred me to finally put it in book form.
Mm-hmm. You speak about the pianist Bill Charlap apparently having taken a lesson or two with you, and I was very intrigued to hear you say that you gave Bill a basic directive, Jimmy Rolls, Sonny Clark, referring there, of course, to two brilliant, legendary pianists. Tell me a little bit more about what that was intended to convey to Bill Charlap.
Well, it was at a time when Bill was just starting to perform as a professional, and it was just after I had come to New York, so we're talking 32 years ago, and I had heard him play, and he used to come and listen to me at the Knickerbocker and Bradley's and various places around New York, and he said, I'd like to take a lesson, and I said, well, you know what, I'm really not teaching formally, let me give you a four-word lesson, Jimmy Rolls, Sonny Clark. And he said, what do you mean? I said, go and give them a serious listen. I said, I think what you could use in your playing at this particular point is more spaciousness, more space, fewer notes. So that was the lesson.
And you found both of those artists to be exemplars of more space and fewer notes.
Yeah, I thought they were, and still do, very important pianists, and certainly two people that all budding jazz pianists should be aware of.
Mm-hmm. You know, you begin one of the chapters with a Jimmy Rolls sort of quip that goes, when you think of an idea, just play half of it.
Yeah. Jimmy said, this is my advice to vocal accompanists. When you think of an idea, play half of it. A lot of truth to that.
Bill, I'd like to take a minute here to, or a couple of minutes actually, to play a selection that, I asked you in advance if you could recommend a title or two from your own work, and one that jumped out for me was Wigwise by Duke Ellington, and why did you select this as something for us to listen to?
Well, that's one of my favorite, my personal favorites of the records I've done. It was with John Goldsby on bass and Lewis Nash playing drums, done for Concord Records in about 1994 or 95. The album was called An Ellington Affair. It's all Ellington and Strayhorn music. And Wigwise is a song that's not often played, and it's an up-tempo number and just a beautiful Ellington composition.
Let's give it a listen right now. Bill Mays at the piano playing Duke Ellington's Wigwise. ¶¶ That's Bill Mays at the piano playing Duke Ellington's Wigwise. Bill, I know that work from Money Jungle, Ellington's legendary date with Mingus and Max Roach.
That's right. That's where I learned the tune from.
I love your rendition. Fast.
Yeah. Great record they made, Money Jungle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, speaking of Duke Ellington, I was really surprised in your book, Stories of the Road, to read of your first solo record. You said it was produced by Irving Mills. And I got to say, I've been an Ellingtonian. I saw Duke in 1966 at the age of 13. It absolutely changed my life, and I have been just fanatical for Ellington and, you know, and a kind of homespun scholar of Duke Ellington ever since. And you're the first person I think I've ever spoken with who had a connection with Irving Mills. I'm all ears.
Yeah, well, Irving Mills, of course, was responsible for, presenting Ellington in a few different important settings. He also put his name on a lot of the music, taking, credit for music that he didn't write or contribute to, but that's another story, and has happened a lot, unfortunately, in the music business. But my involvement with him was in a whole other framework. He had started a label, a record label called Musical Cocktail Records, and he called me and said that he was doing a series of jazz pianists, each guy playing a different composer, and so I chose Cole Porter and did an LP for him, probably five, I guess we did maybe 10 or 11 tunes of Cole Porter's. And I got a great story out of it, as you know, having read my book. He fell asleep during the session, and something the engineer said happened often. He was quite elderly at that time.
Sure.
And the engineer on the project had done others of these records. He said, just finish what's on the list there, and here's your check.
What year was that?
My involvement with Irving Mills was welcome to the project. Play about 5 minutes on each tune. Do a little improvising. Don't take it way outside, and don't make it too long. Uh-huh. And then he fell asleep, and that was that.
What year would that have been?
Well, I don't recall it exactly, but it would be roughly around 1968, 69.
Okay, yeah. And, of course, we're referring with Irving Mills to the man who was essentially Duke Ellington's manager from the late 20s until the late 30s, and he brought Duke through the Cotton Club period when Ellington rose to great prominence and a number of other milestones. Ellington's first tours of Europe and of Great Britain and all were during Irving Mills' period. And, and as you mentioned, of course, Mills took the prerogative of adding his name as a co-composer to many of Ellington's great works. And as you say, that's another story. But thanks for this story from Stories of the Road. I wanted to try to get to a couple of other things before we let you go here. And I'm speaking with Bill Mays, who's brought out this volume called Stories of the Road, The Studios, Sidemen, and Singers, 55 Years in the Music Biz. And it is a very engaging collection of vignettes from the many encounters and many roads that Bill has traveled as a pianist. I'm kind of discerning an MO of yours, which is to get out of disagreeable situations, you seem to ask for more money. Is that true? And it doesn't always seem to have worked. It seems as though oftentimes when you relate a story like that, you actually got the dough you asked for.
I guess all musicians have been there. Yeah, I guess there's a couple stories about that too. But again, that's people can flesh those out when they read the book. That's an old trick about how to get out of a gig you don't really want to do. Just ask for way too much money, and chances are you won't get it, and no hard feelings. And it's better that they they remembered that they couldn't afford you than that they got you for cheap.
Right. Well, if we could bring this up to, you know, to a kind of conclusion here, we began, sadly, having to refer to Phil Wood's passing, and you mentioned that you worked extensively with Mark Murphy, and of course, we've lost Mark recently as well. You did the arrangements for his great Bob for Kerouac record. Tell us a little bit about Mark Murphy.
True individual, visionary artist, and happily to report a ball to work with on a record, because he, while giving me lots of artistic freedom, also was a very big contributor with ideas about how he wanted a tune to go. And so, let's see, I did actually 3 or 4 records with him as producer and arranger, Bob for Kerouac Then and Now, Beauty and the Beast, and I worked on another one called One for Junior. Kenny Barron, I think, was also the pianist on some of those tracks. Mm-hmm. So Mark was a total pleasure, a real chance taker,
yep.
And I thoroughly enjoyed my time with him.
I had an amazing experience, if you'll indulge me, driving into New York about, maybe 10 years ago now, with a friend who wanted to present Mark in a special kind of charitable concert series that he runs every year in Hartford. And we were listening to Mark as we drove into the city. It was a very hot July Sunday afternoon. We were headed into the city for a special sort of birthday event around Lee Konitz's work, and he was playing at Iridium. And we pulled into Manhattan at about the West Side Highway at about 3 o'clock on that Sunday afternoon. And again, I say it was unbelievably hot that day. And we've got Mark blasting for like the last 2 hours in the car. And we pull in off the West Side. We're in maybe the 20s and around 8th or 10th Avenue at a traffic light. And who is standing on the corner but Mark Murphy in an ankle-length leather coat? And we pulled up and were, of course, exclaiming, you know, our surprise at hearing him. Mark was somewhat unimpressed, but he was waiting for a car service to pick him up. He had finished a gig at Birdland, and Mark ended up making the concert, you know, several months later for us in Hartford. Yeah. But that was one of the great coincidences that I'll experience in this life.
Yeah.
Well, Bill Mays, a pleasure to talk with you today, and I hope to see you on the bandstand soon. I saw you at Mesro last summer with Todd Coolman for a minute or two, and we had that nice encounter in which you surprised me with the book. And actually, as I recall, you mentioned that, you know, with Phil and so many other artists writing memoirs and stories of this kind of their own, that felt inspiring to you. And just remind us again that the inspiration for making the benefit of this book for the Musicians Fund of the AF of M.
Yes, and all proceeds going to the Musicians Assistance Program. Because of that, I'm not selling the book through any commercial sites because they take too much of the profit. Mm. It's only available through my website, which is billmays.net, and people can click on discography at the website, and they'll see the book and how to order.
Okay, and we'll include a link to that, of course, and we'll place this interview on our website and give it plenty of prominence as well here at New England Public Radio. So, again, enjoy the summer. I hope to see you soon on a bandstand, and thanks for joining us today, Bill.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, and thank you for all the great work you're doing for jazz.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure, too. For additional material and music on Bill Mays, join yours truly, Tom Reaney, for Jazz on the Mode weeknights between 8 and 11 on New England Public Radio, and check the Jazz blog at nepr.net. Thanks to Kyle Sullivan for production assistance. For Jazz Beat, I'm Tom Reaney.